study of meaning. Semantics isn't simply about words. It's about the context in which those words are used. It's about understanding. He once remarked that 99% of all conflicts are about the misunderstanding of words used in different contexts. His success, therefore, came from trying diligently to understand what someone meant. The endeavor is all the more significant today because when Mark Zuckerberg decided to call everyone on Facebook friends, he made a semantic choice that is easily misunderstood. The human brain, to say nothing of the human heart, cannot process hundreds of friends. According to Oxford University professor of evolutionary anthropology Robin Dunbar, the size of our brain limits our ability to manage social circles to around 150 friends, regardless of our sociability. Dunbar has looked at Facebook and found it to be true online as well. The interesting thing is that you can have 1,500 friends, but when you actually look at traffic on sites, you see people maintain the same inner circle of around 150 people that we observe in the real world. But here, it is important to introduce Dunbar to Minow, because Dunbar defines a friend as someone you care about and contact at least once a year. Distinctions must be made, for while we cannot have 150 intimate friends, we can have 150 influential relationships. Intimate friendships possess deep commitment and are based on great risk. First comes the risk of believing that we are people who matter enough, who are weighty enough to influence others' lives. If we do not understand the significance of our presence, we can never give anyone the present of our lives. But an equally great risk is that having intimate friends opens us up to being deeply hurt by those friends. Some people protect themselves from relational pain by having no intimate friends. Others do it by having so many shallow friends that a hurt inflicted by one is diffused by the mass. The bottom line is that relationship involves risk. And if we want to influence other people's lives, we have to be comfortable accepting that risk. While the amount we give of ourselves varies based on the relational intimacy we are seeking, risk is always implicit in the process of moving people from curious followers to certain friends with whom you have influence that transcends transactional trends. Once you know what matters to others through a practice of listening, placing your matters in a holding pattern is the only way to truly engage others with a steady diet of what they care about. And, as with most meaningful risks, the reward is commensurate. Subsequent influence is more potent, and there soon comes a time when what matters to you matters to them. Jamie Twerkowski understands. In 2002, a friend named Renee was using the same razor blade to line her cocaine and cut her arms. Depressed, alone, and surrounded by friends who were spiraling down with her, Renee was not long for this world. Jamie, an unassuming surfboard sales rep, stepped in and with a group of friends intervened in Renee's world. Eschewing emotional risk, they tried to give her the gift of presence. They bought her coffee and cigarettes. They gave her music. They surrounded her with love. They wondered what it would be like if, instead of her cutting a self-loathing four-letter moniker into her arm, they could write love on her arms. Jamie's friendship with Renee led him to design some t-shirts to sell to support the cost of her recovery program. His friendship with the lead singer of a popular rock band led him to ask a favor of the frontman. Wear one of our t-shirts on stage. The musician did. Nearly a decade later, Renee is clean, and Jamie's organization, To Write Love on Her Arms, sells nearly $3 million in t-shirts a year and invests that money in numerous recovery programs. More than 200,000 follow Jamie on Twitter and Facebook, but he knows most are curious fans and followers. A much smaller number are friends, such as Renee. He has some slight influence with those who follow him, yet it is shallower than the influence he has with his friends, and mostly fleeting. He accepts this, and celebrates that there are others in the world also doing good things worthy of following. He has strong influence with his friends. This is the malleable setting in which he chooses to reside. It is this place, different for everyone, where you must reside, whether you're a multinational corporation or an individual change agent. The distinction between your friends and your followers is an important one to consider when seeking to make a lasting impression on others. There are those in this world with whom you have earned significant influence. They are a gift and a responsibility. You should not only know who they are, but also know what matters to them. The gift is what they bring to you. Value it. The responsibility is to lead your relationship somewhere meaningful to both of you, but at the very least, to them. A brand's ability to have its message put in front of millions of people begins and ends with that impression, concludes Mitch Joel in his aforementioned blog post. He continues, "We as a public seem to believe that the influence comes from the sheer volume of impressions and connections that we have in the marketplace. It doesn't. True influence comes from connecting to the individuals, nurturing those relationships, adding real value to the other people's lives, and doing anything and everything to serve them, so that when the time comes for you to make an ask, there is someone there to lend a hand. Worry less about how many people you are connected to, and worry a whole lot more about who you are connected to, who they are, and what you are doing to value and honor them. Perhaps what is most meaningful to you, after all, is being meaningful to others. One thing is certain. In an age when the mass of messages multiplies daily, only a small number really matter. To influence others, make sure yours are among them." Chapter 6. Leave Others a Little Better. "He called himself Mike," began blogger and consummate building champions business coach Steve Scanlon as he relayed a story he loves to share. "My wife Rafa and I were staying a few blocks south of Central Park, and we'd hailed his cab to embark on an annual dining tradition in Little Italy. Our timing was terrible. It was Halloween, and the already crowded streets were twice full. As Mike chopped his way through Midtown and Lower Manhattan, it was apparent our plans would need to change. He suggested Greenwich Village, and we agreed. A few minutes later, he dropped us at a village curb, recommended three restaurants, and then rolled back into the crawling mass. I thought it was the last we'd seen of him. But, as Scanlon likes to say with a smile, Mike thought differently." As they enjoyed their meal, Scanlon reached for the front pocket of his pants. He patted here and there, and there and here. His phone was missing. He panicked as he suddenly remembered where it was. Resignation set in as he imagined the misery of canceling his account, losing valuable contact information, and buying a new phone. He dialed his number from his wife's phone, expecting to hear his own recording. Instead, a gentle Indian accent answered. "Hello?" "Who's this?" Scanlon snapped, brusquer than intended. "This is Mike," the voice said. Scanlon took a breath and fumbled through an explanation that ended with them needing to catch a flight home very soon. "My goodness," Mike replied. "Your phone is very important. I will come as quickly as I can." He then coordinated a street corner meeting and promised to hurry. Scanlon turned to his wife in amazement and relief and explained what was happening. When Mike pulled to the curb 20 minutes later and delivered the phone, Scanlon put $80 in the cabbie's hand, all the cash on him. "He was humbled," explained Scanlon, "but I wanted him to know how outstanding the act was. He hadn't mentioned money once. Turning off his meter and going way out of his way to help an irresponsible customer was extraordinary. I'd have given him twice the cash if I had it on me." This cabbie's small act of service made a big impact. It turned a nightmare into noteworthy experience. Scanlon calls what Mike did small picture thinking, it is the foundation of leaving others a little better. Somewhere along the way, we were taught to keep the big picture at the forefront of our minds. We learned the benefits of setting big goals, making big connections, and closing big deals. Today, the most common big picture may be gaining a big following. And while such big pictures have value, if our minds are focused only on big payoffs, we will overlook the small opportunities that make the biggest difference. We will miss chances to go a little deeper, to connect a little tighter, to make others feel that much better about their relationship with us. The point, explained Scanlon, is not that big picture thinking is bad. It is a necessary piece of progress, especially with people, but it alone is not enough to reach your big goals. Many steps come between what we sow and what we reap. Most are small seeds planted in the small moments of every day. Consider the sales manager at Macy's who cast a big vision to double women's shoe sales in June. There would be a big summer sale, he explained, and in combination with a big push in upselling, that would turn out big results. What resulted, unfortunately, was no big deal. June 1st came, and his sales force stopped listening to the customers' stories. They stopped being sensitive to customers' budgets and considerate of their time. Instead, they began fishing for big opportunities to suggest a more expensive shoe or a half-priced second pair or a matching accessory. By month's end, total sales had decreased by 8%. What went wrong? A typical sales manager might blame his sales team for lack of execution. This particular manager pointed the finger at himself. What could he have done differently? He realized his big-picture obsession had taken his team's focus off the small actions that would make it a reality. It is a common mistake. Fortunately, this particular manager had a second chance. A few months later, Macy's was having a Labor Day sale. The sales manager took a different approach. He painted the same big picture, double the previous month's sales, but this time he described the small details within the big picture. He asked his people to look for every opportunity to serve their customers, walk them to the bathroom, hold their babies, park their strollers behind the counter, be mindful of their time commitments and budget constraints. Instead of focusing on what they were selling, the sales team should focus on making their customers' days a little better, whether or not they bought shoes. What do you think happened? Total sales for September were 40% higher than August. It was not a doubling of sales, a goal even the manager admitted was quite lofty, but it was 50% better than the same effort in June. Most important, it was progress. The difference was in the details. The big picture didn't change. The salespeople's focus did. Instead of looking for the big sell, they sought small, meaningful ways to leave people a little better. The smaller seeds, sown meaningfully, reaped a bigger harvest. Many people make the mistake of equating inspiration with implementation. They are like an art teacher who sets his students down in an alpine meadow and asks them to reproduce the glorious landscape. The big picture is inspiring, long, swaying grass, white aspens with shimmering golden leaves, a brook winding toward the backdrop of snow-capped mountains. But merely seeing the picture does not equip the students to skillfully depict one blade of grass on the canvas. Without instruction in painting each small detail in that big picture, their efforts will look nothing like that picturesque meadow before them. To become great artists who can replicate the big picture, the students must learn to focus on the small particulars. Nowhere in life is this truer than in human relations. Who doesn't have grand plans for certain partnerships, collaborative efforts, or friendships? A marriage proposal is nothing if not a vision for the future of the relationship. A collaboration agreement is nothing if not a vision for the future of the business partnership. An employment agreement is nothing more than a vision of the great work an employer and employee can accomplish together, But is it enough to wax poetic about your love for the woman? Is it enough to promise great customer service, relevant content, or valuable support? It is said that Leonardo da Vinci began painting Mona Lisa in 1503 and did not finish until 1519. Some art historians speculate he spent much of that span considering and crafting the enigmatic smile that has been the centerpiece of conversation for 5 centuries. The famous smile now adorns its own $7.5 million room in the Louvre, where 6 million visitors pay their respects each year. The painting's value is estimated in the ballpark of $500 million, though most claim she is priceless. What would Mona Lisa be without its most famous detail? A big picture that never realized its potential. In the same respect, your biggest and best intentions for a relationship, for your followership, for a company or collaborative endeavor will regularly fall short of their potential if your inspirational intentions do not translate into small acts of service and value. Most business people treat customer service like an ad campaign, said Scanlon. They post it, promise it, and promote it, but unless they produce it in small increments every day, customer service is only lip service. It is Mona Lisa without the smile. A nice effort, but not that different from anything or anyone else. What you must always remember is that what motivates you to win friends is rarely what motivates others to grant you friendship. You are motivated by what can be achieved with others' loyalty or support or collaborative effort. You are motivated by the big picture of connection and collaboration, by how things can be. In contrast, those with whom you want to connect and collaborate see only the small pictures of their own experience with you. They see the true measure of your motives in bites and feats. They are motivated by how things are. Others are constantly asking of you, how valuable is my relationship with this person? What have you done for me lately still guides the mind of the masses, perhaps more so today amid the backdrop of millions of messages and messengers vying for attention. This does not suggest, as some believe, that you must continually outdo yourself or that you must parade as a spectacle. It simply means that the secret to all interpersonal progress is adding value and doing so with regularity. Unfortunately, in the digital age, winning friends has come to be about marketing, about standing out, about being significant, said legendary peak performance coach Tony Robbins in a recent interview. There are 2 ways to be significant, he explained. Do something really well, or do something really poorly. Unfortunately, infamy is the easiest way to get known today. Technology gives us the incredible power to connect with, learn from, and add value to any person on the planet 24/7. And yet, we can burn someone or be foolish and get significance instantly. It is unfortunate many people choose that path. Besides the obvious relational consequences of this tack, the strategic problem is that there is no shortage of provocative items being broadcast in the digital age. Between media outlets, marketing campaigns, and me-first digital manners, your competition on the stage of sustaining interest is colossal, and the rewards are famously shallow. The real key to winning friends and influencing people today, says Robbins, is moving relationships from manipulative to meaningful. The only way you do that is by constantly adding meaning and value. This is the scale on which every one of your interactions is judged. Every tweet, post, email, call, and tangible encounter. To which side does your scale tip in each encounter? Toward more value or less value? To which side does your scale tip over time? That is perhaps the more important question, because we all make mistakes. We have bad days. Still, the fallout of interpersonal failures can be swifter and more merciless than it has ever been before. For that reason alone, It is wisest to do everything within your power, through every medium and every message, to leave others a little better. While we certainly have some room for error, it's more of a laundry room than a grand ballroom. How many times has a mere glance put a relationship on the fritz? Various traditions tell of gods and goddesses of justice. Themis, a titan, was an organizer of communal affairs. Dike was the Greek goddess of justice who weighed right and wrong. Justitia was the Roman personification of justice, forced to ascend to the heavens because of the wrongdoing of mortals. Maat was the Egyptian goddess who held the universe in order until the moment of creation and then became a heavenly regulator. Out of these gods and goddesses arose a more modern personification of justice, the blindfolded, sword-holding, scale-bearing image associated with Western judicial systems. Her message couldn't be simpler. Truth must be weighed on a case-by-case basis for truth to prevail. A subtler message is this. Anything can tip the scales. There isn't an idle argument or irrelevant fact in a case. The scales of justice measure it all. What's true in justice holds true in human relationships. There are no neutral exchanges. You leave someone either a little better or a little worse. Jordan was assessing his divorce a decade after it occurred on the eve of his second wedding. A friend asked why his first one failed. It was, he said, because he neglected the scales. Every single interaction with his spouse sent her one of two messages, that she was the most important person in the world to him, or that she wasn't. He'd sent the latter message far too often. It is unrealistic to expect every exchange with every person to be life-altering. But your scale still tips one way or another every day. Knowing this should give you plenty of reasons to pay attention to every message you send. Placing this high a priority on altruism would set you apart in this digital age. New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote a column called High Five Nation, in which he contrasted the humility on display after Japan's surrender at the end of World War II with what we see on display today. He wrote, "On the day of victory, fascism had stood for grandiosity, pomposity, boasting, and zeal. The Allied propaganda mills had also produced their fair share of polemical excess. By 1945, everybody was sick of that. There was a mass hunger for a public style that was understated, self-abnegating, modest, and spare. Humility, and the sense that others should occupy our minds as much as, if not more than, we do, was part of the culture of that era. Over time, the sentiment began to change," writes Brooks. "Instead of being humble before God and history, moral salvation could be found through intimate contact with oneself. Self-exposure and self-love became ways to win shares in the competition for attention." Certainly, some people have gained attention today, perhaps notoriety is a better word, by worshiping themselves and creating a culture of celebrity around themselves. Some make millions off this strategy. But what is our impression of such people? Do they influence others for good? Perhaps, after all the attention, they point people to a cultural good, which is better than nothing. But such people serve primarily as provocateurs. Like wine before a bland meal, they prepare our palate for nothing substantial. There is one thing that hasn't changed over the millennia, something philosophers from every culture have concluded. It is as old as history itself. Zoroaster taught it to his followers in Persia 2,500 years ago. Confucius preached it in China 2,400 years ago. Lao Tzu taught it to his disciples in the Valley of the Han. Buddha preached it on the bank of the Holy Ganges around the same time. The sacred books of Hinduism taught it 1,000 years before that. They all concluded, don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you. 2,000 years ago, Jesus put a slightly different spin on it. Do to others what you would have them do to you. It is the only rule in human history we call golden. An ironic advantage of our digital age is that many people hold a notion of superiority, which affords you a simple way to make a lasting impression. Show them in some subtle way they are right. They are far more likely to return the favor. "You know why I like you, Ike?" Winston Churchill asked President Dwight Eisenhower, who had labored more or less harmoniously alongside the strong personalities of Bernard Law Montgomery, Charles de Gaulle, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. "Because you ain't no glory hopper." Always leave people a little better, and you might be surprised how big it makes you and how far it takes you. Part 3. How to Merit and Maintain Others' Trust. Chapter 1. Avoid Arguments. In their book, The Preacher and the Presidents, co-authors Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy detail the Reverend Billy Graham's path of unlikely ascendance and unmatched influence with not only 7 U.S. presidents, but also nearly every other global leader in the Western world. This path, they point out, was not without its resistance, especially early on. How Graham dealt with one of his staunchest opponents provides a preview of the first principle necessary for winning others' trust. In February 1954, they write, Graham's patron, Henry Luce, wrote to Times Man in London, the legendary correspondent, André Laguerre, to prepare him for what was about to come when Graham landed in London for a spring crusade. This was a time when church membership was much lower in Britain, between 5% and 15% of the population, than it was in the United States, 59%. "Religion in Britain is near death," Luce noted, "so Billy's impact will be worth watching. Surely he will be scorned by all the people you know." One of those scorners, explains Gibbs and Duffy, was a columnist from the Daily Mirror, a man named William Connor, who called Graham Hollywood's version of John the Baptist. As he often did with prominent critics, Graham suggested they meet in person. Connor mischievously suggested a rendezvous at a pub called The Baptist's Head. As it turned out, neither Luce, Laguerre, nor Connor could estimate the effect Graham would have on the city. So many people came the first week that from then on, he held 3 meetings at Haringey Stadium on Saturdays. Night after night, 11,000 people sat and another 1,000 stood in rain or sleet or cold to hear him preach. His audience included members of Parliament, an admiral, and the Navy Chief of Staff. Nor could the journalists estimate the effect Graham would have on them personally, especially William Connor. After meeting the preacher for a chat at the irreverently named pub, Connor the critic became Connor the admirer. "I never thought," he confessed of Graham in a subsequent column, "that friendliness had such a sharp, cutting edge. I never thought that simplicity could cudgel us sinners so damned hard. We live and learn." While Graham could have employed a front of passive aggression by ignoring the cheeky jabs or fought the jabs with press-worthy indignation, he chose a higher road, a far more effective path. He avoided an argument altogether and won his critic over with grace and goodwill. Arguing with another person will rarely get you anywhere. They usually end with each person more firmly convinced of his rightness. You may be right, dead right, but arguing is just as futile as if you were dead wrong. Humorist Dave Barry made this point quite well when he said, "I argue very well. Ask any of my remaining friends. I can win an argument on any topic, against any opponent. People know this and steer clear of me at parties. Often, as a sign of their great respect, they don't even invite me." So much of our time online is spent arguing or feeding arguments. Look no further than comments at the bottom of popular blogs and news sites. It's nearly always a string of he said, she said, or attempts at one-upmanship. Beyond that, the recent and ongoing corporate and political banter seems to primarily involve proving points and stating cases instead of finding common ground on which to build something of mutual value. Few of these arguments change people's minds. Because the arguments are digitally veiled and lack the clear-cut consequences of tangible confrontations, both parties can get away with devolving into snarky personal attacks and passive ambiguity, the least effective tools of human relations. Such was the case when former BP chief executive Tony Hayward took a hard line of personal self-exoneration and arrogant apathy in reaction to the tragic Deepwater Horizon explosion and subsequent oil spill that took 11 human lives, ravaged the Gulf state's ecosystem, and devastated the livelihood of thousands more workers around the country. According to an article in The Times, he started by refuting scientific findings about the nature and amount of the spill. Then his contention that the spill was tiny compared to the size of the ocean and that the environmental impact of America's biggest oil spill and of the 950,000 gallons of toxic dispersant that have been used to treat it would be very, very modest, set off a series of gaffes from which he could not recover, including a backhanded apology to the people of Louisiana, in which he stated, "I would like my life back." When, 2 days after dodging questions and ditching blame before U.S. lawmakers, he was found in Cowes on the southern coast of England for a yacht race in which his boat Bob was entered, it merely highlighted what had already been established. Whether or not he was right, Hayward had lost both his credibility and his case in the court of public opinion. When influence and impact are at stake, it is often the only court that matters. After his line of argument, few could trust the man. He seemed to care about two things and two things only, himself and his empire. Under his argumentative approach, BP quickly went from suspect to reject, regardless of what story the facts would turn out to tell. Wherever BP was sold to consumers, boycotting began. Why fill up at a BP station when there were a dozen others belonging to companies that didn't have fearlessly uncaring leaders trying to argue their way to exoneration? Some of the chain of reaction was based on perception, of course, but reality remains perception when the facts aren't clear. And when the case is in the realm of human relations, perception is often so strong that even irrefutable facts are not enough to supplant the wave of bad press that preceded them. In Hayward's defense, after his dismissal from BP, a day he called one of the saddest of his life, he was far more empathetic not only about his company's role in the spill, but also about his approach to the tragedy. Friends laud Hayward as a kind and generous family man, and there is no doubt they have good reason. Furthermore, BP has been a solid, respectable company for decades. Both deserve to be valued for their finest moments, no less than any of us would had our argumentative approach with a spouse, colleague, or client been widely publicized. And both Hayward and BP still likely will. But why not avoid the valleys in the first place? We will face conflict nearly every day of our lives. So how do we prevent a tactful discussion from becoming an aggressive argument? In the end, you must value interdependence higher than independence and understand that deferential negotiation is more effective in the long run than a non-compliant crusade. One South American leader has proven this principle's merit despite great historical and personal odds. For a man who came from poverty, who led a labor union in a country not known for workers' rights, who watched his wife die when she was 8 months pregnant because they couldn't afford adequate health care, and who formed his own political party, one might expect a fighter. But Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, called Lula by all, defied expectations at every turn. "My mother always said two people can't fight if one person doesn't want to," Lula told a reporter once. And so, Lula doesn't fight. An approach that helped him become the president of Brazil and hold the position for almost 10 years. When his newly formed Socialist Party lost elections year after year, he developed an alliance with a right-wing party and courted business leaders despite his social goals. When he became president on the promise to prioritize the impoverished in Brazil, he also built alliances with Brazil's wealthy and vast upper class by focusing on growing the economy. I consider myself a negotiator. If we want peace and democracy, we have to be tolerant, to negotiate more, he has said. Lula's tolerance and negotiation helped him achieve astounding things during his time in office. Through building alliances, both domestically and internationally, he enacted social programs that pulled more than 20 million people out of poverty and into the middle class, while also creating a period of strong economic growth and stability. In a country known for the vast divide between the rich and the poor, Lula's people skills put Brazil on course to reverse historical inequalities. The notion of communication has been greatly misinterpreted, explains corporate behavioral specialist Esther Jealous. We have come to believe it is all about the delivery. In doing so, we regularly forfeit the full potential of our exchanges. Jealous reminds the executives and employees of corporate clients such as 20th Century Fox, Leo Burnett, and Harpo Inc. that there is an important reason all personal growth techniques spring from the act of listening to your inner wisdom. Inside us all is a vault of better self-understanding, higher knowledge, and greater ideas, she explains. Tension and conflict occur when you, and or those with you, discard the notion that others also have inner wisdom that ought to be heard. How then do we build a practice of avoiding arguments? See the singular advantage of operating interdependently. This occurs, says Jealous, when you acknowledge that greater interpersonal results are always more probable when your experience and insight are compounded with that of others. No matter how expressive or persuasive you might be, this does not occur by one person trumping another. It occurs when the end result of the tension is a mutual stretching of insight and personal growth. And if you can see your interactions clearly, despite tension and conflict, there is little you can't accomplish in collaboration with others. All of us know how to get attention, asserts Jealous, but few of us know how to get attention and respect at the same time. Set yourself apart by being one who avoids the arguments that most jump into with both feet. Chapter 2. Never say you're wrong. The best solution, wisest decision, and brightest idea nearly always exist outside of what one party brings to the table. Yet we find it quite easy to declare another person wrong, often before we've taken the time to consider what he or she is saying. Even when we believe another is wrong, there is only one way to guarantee an unenviable end to an interaction and all chance of connection or meaningful collaboration, and that is to tell the other person we think so. Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. Those who learn the wrong lessons from the past may be equally doomed, writes Harvard Business School professor and co-author of Negotiation Genius, Deepak Malhotra, in the opening of a Forbes.com article comparing the 2011 NFL revenue share dispute with a similar dispute between the owners and players of the National Hockey League in 2004-05. In both disputes, the owners, concerned about rising costs, asked the players to accept a smaller share of league revenues. In both disputes, the players rejected the owner's request and asked to see proof of the rising costs. In both disputes, the owners initially refused to substantiate their claims. In the NHL, the situation turned dire because neither would back down. Accusations of greed were rampant, explains Malhotra. Unable to bridge the divide even months after the collective bargaining agreement had expired, the NHL eventually canceled the season. $2 billion in revenues were lost. Was the result a foregone conclusion? According to Malhotra, it was avoidable if only the sides had understood the basic human relations problem at the heart of the matter. Both sides lost the season because the owners refused to acknowledge that players had legitimate concerns. By seeing them as greedy rather than mistrusting, the owners adopted the wrong strategy, intransigence rather than transparency, for too long. The dispute fell into the trap of "I'm right, you're wrong," because neither would consider the alternative, that perhaps both were right. There is a critical lesson here. Negotiations become more productive, concludes Malhotra, when each party acknowledges that the other may have legitimate concerns. In the NFL dispute, both the owners and the players need to bring a more nuanced perspective to the bargaining table, or fans across America may be doing something other than watching pro football games next fall. Nuance, or subtle difference, is a critical concept to remember in the midst of disagreement. In most disputes, our differences with others are far subtler than we allow ourselves to see. We so easily treat dissonance like a chasm that cannot be crossed, the only resolution being one party taking a dive or being shoved off the cliff, so that only one party remains. It's far from the truth. Friendship that exists upon agreement on all matters is not worth the name, exhorted Mahatma Gandhi. Friendship, to be real, must ever sustain the weight of honest differences, however sharp they be. The truth is that disagreement is more often a small crack in the sidewalk that can be easily negotiated if we come to the discussion table with a more open mind. We talk because we know something, explained corporate behavioral specialist Esther Jellis in a recent interview. Or we think we know something, or in the workplace, because there is an expectation that we should know something. This expectation of knowledge tends to work against us in interactions because it closes off our minds to the possibilities that exist outside the knowledge we bring to the table. We enter interactions with corroboration in mind, and if that corroboration does not come, we spend the remainder of the interaction attempting to either rebut the other's assessment or rebuke the other's right to make an assessment in the first place. The result is that collaboration, or the possibility of it, is forfeited. If that's your approach, you will rarely progress far in relationships. All effective problem solving, collaboration, and dispute resolution, said Jellis, begins with an emptying of the mind, of what we know or what we think we should know. This can feel incredibly unnatural, she admitted, because we have been trained to demonstrate what we think, to show our knowledge, our smarts. We think, therefore we talk. Yet, by approaching a conversation with a blank slate, we take a humbler and more honest approach. We acknowledge the possibility that we may not know all the facts, and that we may not, in fact, be the only one who is right. Better yet, we create the possibility for meaningful collaboration, the melting of thoughts, ideas, and experiences into something greater than the sum of two parties. The notion that we might not be the only one who is right, and that we may in fact also be wrong, is, of course, nearly always the case, but we seem so averse to admitting it. Why is that? More often than not, it is because we value personal victory over collaborative possibility. Yet in doing so, we not only stunt the relationship, we also punt the probability of greater progress than we originally considered. We expect too little if in the midst of disagreement we only seek a winner. Jellis shared the following story from her experience with a well-known media conglomerate whose swift response to a national disaster caused an aftermath of in-house conflict. Her cell rang at midnight. It was the president of a media conglomerate that had retained her. The man needed Jellis to facilitate a meeting first thing in the morning to deal with an assembly line of catastrophes. The president was referring to the Hurricane Katrina tragedy. In the wake of one of the United States' worst natural disasters, his company had swiftly deployed 90% of its employees to various regions of the Gulf Coast. No planning, no strategy, just some general instructions to come back with the important stories. Now, 2 weeks later, the teams had returned to the realities of resuming business in the severely disjointed aftermath. "I have four production teams fighting about whose coverage should take priority," the president explained. "I have legal fighting with production about waiting for proper vetting. And I have accounting fighting with everyone about divvying up the huge expense of the whole thing." He paused briefly, then went on to tell her how much it had cost. 6 times more than any previous production. Jealous's role, said the president, was to meet with all the bickering leadership teams and help them talk it out. Jealous knew precisely what to do. The next morning, as she sat in the auditorium where the meeting was to be held, she watched a familiar sight. The executives and their senior staff each entered the auditorium metaphorically carrying a case, the case they would state to win the dispute. As they settled into their seats, she jumped in with an invitation. "I would like everyone to take a moment and ask yourself this question. What could I have done differently during this assignment that would have helped the other departments succeed?" In her head, Jealous says, she could hear a series of thuds as the talking heads dropped their verbal cases to the floor. Ears then perked up around the room as, one by one, the team leaders shared their in-the-future-we-could thoughts. The CFO began by suggesting that his accounting and production teams could lay out a preliminary budget for projects. "We don't have time," the executive vice president of production barked back, "for sitting around and making budgets when a story is breaking." Jealous intervened with a question. "Can you see why accounting is suggesting this practice?" "So we don't overspend," the executive vice president replied. "Accounting," Jealous added, "has an imperative function for the survival of this company, equally as important as production." She then asked the chief financial officer and the executive vice president of production, "Could your two departments collaborate on creating a preliminary budget for weekly assignments and a breaking news budget with moving caps based on crisis proportions?" Both nodded. The mediation moved on. The company's chief counsel suggested legal could compose a most common vetting problems document so production would know beforehand how to avoid long vetting processes. Jealous looked at the executive vice president, who was nodding. "That would be very helpful," she agreed. "Done," replied the chief counsel. The meeting continued in this manner, even going so far as to roll out the specifics of suggested items, including budgets and documents. Within 30 minutes, everyone in the room was in agreement about the solutions. The meeting was formally adjourned, and it was then that perhaps the most surprising thing of all happened. Many executives and their staff stayed behind to capitalize on the collaboration momentum. As Jealous picked up her bag to leave, the president approached. "In 25 years," he asserted, "I have never attended a meeting where there were more people listening than talking." In the spirit of all great artisans who begin with only a blank page, white canvas, or lump of clay, we must enter all disputes with a mind open to what more we might discover and produce together. Only then can our true interpersonal potential be tapped. On June 26, 2000, in the White House's East Room, where Teddy Roosevelt used to box, where Amy Carter had her high school prom, and where Lewis and Clark once camped in their tents, President Bill Clinton announced the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. "Humankind is on the verge of gaining immense new power to heal," he remarked. Next to him stood Dr. Francis Collins, noted geneticist and the head of the Human Genome Project. For 7 years, he had led an international team of more than 1,000 scientists in what Time journalist J. Madeline Nash called the challenge of pulling off a technological tour de force that many ranked alongside splitting the atom and landing men on the moon. "There is only one human genome project, and it will happen only once," Collins said at the time. "The chance to stand at the helm of that project and put my own personal stamp on it is more than I could imagine." That Collins had to do it while competing against a former colleague made it all the more interesting. In May 1998, 5 years after Collins agreed to helm the project, Craig Venter, a passionate NIH biologist who was among the countless scientists dedicated to harnessing genomes to cure diseases, announced he was founding a company to scoop Collins's project by 4 years. The race between Collins and Venter made for great press. Central to ongoing commentary were the two men's very different personalities, one brash, one reserved. And Collins, the reserved one, had little choice but to compete. Doing so meant getting scientists from 6 countries, numerous government agencies, and many more numerous university labs to work together for a common interest rather than individual glory. So it was even more remarkable that in the East Room that day, Francis Collins introduced Craig Venter this way. Articulate, provocative, and never complacent, he has ushered in a new way of thinking about biology. It is an honor and a pleasure to invite him to tell you about this landmark achievement. Collins chose a path of cooperation and partnership and resisted the temptation to proclaim Venter wrong. Ultimately, he merely saw him as different. But different didn't have to mean opposed. While Collins admits the two are different people, wired in a different way, Times Nash points out, Collins now says that he considers Venter to have been a stimulant in a very positive way. At the heart of the assertion that others are wrong is actually an unspoken admittance that we don't want to be rejected. It is in the spirit of not wanting to be wrong ourselves that we project that role on others. If not for a pointed patent leather reminder, Dale Carnegie himself would have fallen prey to this unenviable reaction. Shortly after the close of World War I, he was the business manager for Sir Ross Smith. During the war, Sir Ross had been the Australian ace out in Palestine. Shortly after peace was declared, he astonished the world by flying halfway around it in 30 days. No such feat had ever been attempted before. It created a tremendous sensation. The Australian government awarded him $50,000. The King of England knighted him. And for a while, he was the talk of the global town. Carnegie was attending a banquet one night given in Sir Ross's honor, and during the dinner, the man sitting next to him told a humorous story that hinged on the quotation, "There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will." The raconteur mentioned that the quotation was from the Bible. He was wrong, and Carnegie knew it positively. By his own admission, he appointed himself as an unsolicited and unwelcome committee of one to correct the storyteller. The other man stuck to his guns. From Shakespeare? Absurd! That quotation was from the Bible, and the man knew it. Frank Gammond, an old friend of Carnegie's, was seated to his left. Gammond had devoted years to the study of Shakespeare, so the storyteller and Carnegie agreed to submit the question to the expert. Mr. Gammond listened, kicked Carnegie under the table, and then said, "Dale, you are wrong. The gentleman is right. It is from the Bible." On their way home that night, Carnegie said to Mr. Gammond, "Frank, you knew that quotation was from Shakespeare." "Yes, of course," he replied. "Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 2. But we were guests at a festive occasion, my dear Dale. Why prove to a man he is wrong? Is that going to make him like you? Why not let him save his face? He didn't ask for your opinion. He didn't want it. Always avoid the acute angle." It taught Carnegie a lesson he never forgot. Telling people they are wrong will only earn you enemies. Few people respond logically when they are told they are wrong. Most respond emotionally and defensively because you are questioning their judgment. You shouldn't just avoid the words, "you're wrong." You can tell people they are wrong by a look, or an intonation, or a gesture, so you must guard against showing judgment in all of the ways that you communicate. And if you're going to prove anything, don't let anybody know it. It is easy to allow a certain tone to creep into our online communication, a tone that tells another person that we believe he or she is wrong. Sometimes we don't even realize the tone is there until we read what we've written sometime later. We believe we are being diplomatic, but each word, presented in absence of expression or a soft tone of voice, is usually a condemnation. This is one of the reasons settling disputes is best accomplished in person. Instead of presenting a truncated argument through email, IM, or Twitter, create a more respectful, conciliatory environment for conversation. Then, offer your point with an open mind. While you in fact might be right and the other person wrong, there is no sense in denting a person's ego or permanently damaging a relationship. If you remember those who obstinately insisted you were wrong, you can be certain others will remember you in that same negative light if you choose to turn an interaction into an opportunity to teach a lesson instead of a chance to strengthen a relationship. Always default to diplomacy. Admit that you may be wrong. Concede that the other person may be right. Be agreeable. Ask questions. And above all, consider the situation from the other's perspective and show that person respect. Such a humble approach leads to unexpected relationships, unexpected collaboration, and unexpected results. Chapter 3. Admit faults quickly and emphatically. Only slightly less of a cliché than "the check is in the mail" is this: the ref blew the call. While the sport and circumstances vary, referees regularly make mistakes. Occasionally, the consequences are significant. Around the world, some are so famous, they have their own monikers. Take the Hand of God goal, for instance. In the 1986 World Cup quarterfinals, Argentina and England were locked in a scoreless tie when Argentina's captain, Diego Maradona, leapt high in the air over goalie Peter Shilton and punched the ball into the net. The referee, Ali bin Nasser, didn't see the handball and ruled the goal legal. Then there was Jeffrey Mayer. In the 1996 American League Championship Series, the Orioles led the Yankees 4-3 in the bottom of the eighth inning when Yankees shortstop Derek Jeter hit a long fly ball into right field. The 12-year-old Mayer reached over the wall and caught the ball, preventing Orioles right fielder Tony Tarasco from making the play. Umpire Rich Garcia improperly called a home run instead of an out or automatic double. The Yankees went on to win the game. Add to these incidents 10,000 other blown calls, and fan exasperation at referee errors can be faintly understood. Certainly we are passionate about our teams, but referees are human after all, and we can understand making mistakes. What makes exasperation linger, however, is the inability or unwillingness of the referees to admit their mistakes. That is what makes one of the worst examples of referee error so extraordinary and ultimately redeeming. It's been called the perfect game robbery. Since 1900, the generally recognized start of baseball's modern era, nearly 400,000 games have been played in the United States. During this span, only 18 times has a pitcher delivered perfection, retiring every opposing batter in order without giving up a walk or a hit and without his teammates putting a runner on base with an error. To put this in perspective, the odds of a perfect game being thrown in baseball, 1 in 20,000, are far smaller than the chance you will be struck by lightning in your lifetime. But a perfect game is precisely what Detroit Tigers pitcher Armando Galarraga had happening one early June evening in 2010. He'd recorded 26 consecutive outs and had gotten the 27th batter to tap a weak ground ball to the first baseman. Galarraga ran from the mound, took the throw from the first baseman, tagged the bag ahead of the runner, and got ready to celebrate. There was only one problem. The umpire, Jim Joyce, swung his arms wide and shouted, "Safe!" Galarraga's perfect game had been lost in one of the most egregious blown calls in sports history. But here is where things took an equally unexpected turn. It is perhaps the most significant and memorable detail of the story. When he got back to the umpire's locker room, Joyce immediately cued the game video and watched the play. Only